Ida Barrianjeri writes for the Los Angeles Times about multicultural issues, immigration, assimilation, and ethnic diversity. Her own heritage is multicultural, African, East Indian, Native American, English, and French. Her new memoir, Every Goodbye Ain't Gone, is a series of sketches about her family and herself. Meg Wolitzer reviewed the book for the New York Times and described it as an impassioned attempt to explore and expose the complexities of an overlooked heritage. The first portrait in the book is about Njeri's grandfather. He was from Guyana and had settled in a small town in Georgia to practice medicine. In 1960, he was killed in a car crash. 23 years after the incident, Njeri decided to return to her grandfather's town to find out what really happened the night of the crash. I asked her how much she knew about her grandfather's death when she arrived in Georgia.
We had only heard the rumors that drunken white youths drag racing through this small southern town had collided with his car, and that one of the drivers of the car was the son, it was alleged, of the sheriff, and that there was a cover-up. Most people believed that the actual accident was that an accident, but that the cover-up was racially motivated. But there were suspicions in some quarters, because it went all over the news in the South, because my grandfather was a prominent civil rights activist who had come to the United States from Georgetown, Guyana, around 1917. And because he was politically active and known to be a supporter of the NAACP, which was considered radical in those days, people believed that it was a racially motivated killing. It was a Klan town, and people knew it was a Klan town. And so I went back 23 years after the fact to find out the circumstances of his death, why he had been killed, was it really an accident, and if there had been a cover-up.
And what did you find?
When I found that, I found a lot of people still afraid. Even my step-grandmother was afraid for me to go back, which was one of the reasons for me to go back, that she could still, almost 25 years later, say, they might desecrate your granddaddy's grave if you go back. That was all the motivation I needed, that she still had such deep, deep fears. I remember the night that he died, hearing stories that she ran out of the house in her nightclothes, her white nightgown flying in the darkness and her long fair hair flying in the night. And as she approached the crowd that had formed around my grandfather's wrecked car and his broken body, she pushed through the crowd and asked the police, what happened, what happened, what happened? They said, oh, don't worry, ma'am, it was just a nigger. Well, they thought she was white. And when I went to that town, I found that one of the members of the jury said, well, you know, we knew him, and he was a nigger. Wasn't much communication between whites and niggers back then, but he was an uppity nigger, and just as well he died that way, because if he hadn't, someone would have shot him. And when I found out that my step-grandmother had filed a civil suit asking for $100,000 in damages and had won, which was surprising that an all-white jury had even given her the small amount of money she did get, which was $6,000, not the $100,000, I asked this juror, well, why such a small sum? And he said, well, you know, that was a lot of money in 1961, $6,000, and after all, he was a nigger, never met a $100,000 nigger.
Well, you actually knocked on the door of the person who was in the car.
Right. I had found out that father...
The person who was
who
in the car that killed him.
Yeah, who was the driver, who had been, I found, named in the local newspaper as the person who was responsible for the accident. And the police report said he was drunk, but he had never been fined in any way. Nothing had happened. And I found out his father was still in Bainbridge, and from his father I found out the man was in Albany, Georgia. I talked to him on the phone. He refused to really, you know, see me. And I tracked him down to Albany with a photographer and went to his door to try to talk to him. To make a long story short, he basically, you know, didn't want to talk to me. And when I went back to Miami, where I then worked for the Herald, to write the story, a woman who lived in the town knew I was working on the story through a friend, I guess, and she came and said she wanted to talk to me. And she said, you know, my family had lived in Bainbridge, too, back in the 30s, when my grandfather had lived there. And she said her uncle had been beaten to death in the woods by a bunch of rednecks. That's how she described them. And the death of her uncle, you know, almost destroyed her entire family. It drove her sister almost insane, her mother almost mad. And she told me, her name was Marjorie Klein, that they had beat him because he was a Jew.
So what feelings were you left with toward the man who drove the car that killed your grandfather?
Well, you know, I depersonalized my feelings to a certain extent because he ceased to be so much an individual as representative of a mindset of people who probably in their minds didn't think they were racist but knew somehow that even if it were only an accident, it was just a black man and that they could heave a sigh of relief and know that it ultimately wouldn't matter. And going back, I recognized that there had been many grandfathers like mine, many uncles like Marjorie Klein's, and that in knocking at this man's door, I was going to bring the past back and that, and to let him know that someone had indeed remembered.
So you thought you did the right thing by reminding him and by being there.
Yeah, I did the right thing.
You write about your father in the new book, and he was a Marxist, he was an intellectual. Someone who would never, though, be accepted into the intellectual establishment because he was black. He also had a negative side, and that is that he was an abuser. He beat your mother. He beat you once. And you really went through your childhood being afraid of him and not liking for him. You went through a period where you'd sleep with a knife under your pillow. Did you ever need it?
I probably did need it, but I was too scared to use it. It was pathetic, you know, a small child. I remember I had found this knife on the street near the house. It was one of those big pocket knives that maybe a Boy Scout might carry. And I saw this glinting, rusted thing, I remember, in the gutter. And it just somehow connected in my mind, and I took this knife home, and I put it under my pillow, you know, it was like an 8-year-old. I'll keep this knife there and I can use it to protect my mother, you know. And I remember a couple of times whenever I heard any loud noises, being startled, afraid that there was going to be some sort of violence in the house, I'd reach for this knife, but I was too scared to use it. I was a child, you know. It was pathetic.
I'm wondering how that left you feeling about raising a family yourself.
I know certainly in my 20s, up until my late 20s, that and certainly now, my relationship with my father certainly colored my attitude toward men. It was like, don't bother me. You know, I don't want to be in a permanent relationship because men just get in the way. They cause problems, you know. And I don't feel that way now. I mean, there are other things one works through when you have a disastrous relationship with a parent. And when a daughter has a bad relationship with a father, the most important male figure in her life, you're always trying to heal that wound. And it's a constant process, as we say, of recovery, you know. But a psychic once said to me, Itabari, I see you standing at a temple door. You are encrusted with gold, and there are hundreds and hundreds of steps behind you. You're just draped, glittering with gold, and you're standing at the temple door, but you're carrying 2 beat-up bags, and you cannot enter the temple door until you release the baggage. And undoubtedly, the baggage was my father, or at least one of those bags. And I know that I have come to at least one of those bags, and that I am traveling much lighter because I have forgiven him. It was a slow, slow process. That same psychic said, light candles, light candles. I lit candles, and then one night I said, I knocked them all off a table and said, the hell with the candles. You were a son of a bitch. You were a mean bastard. I have a right to hate you, and I'm never going to forgive you, even if I have to come back to this life 20 more times. And then gradually, at a much deeper level after that, I really began to forgive my father. I always understood intellectually why he was in such pain, but emotionally, the forgiveness was hard.
Well, at one point, does like your sense of enlightened sociology penetrate to the emotions and allow you to forgive your father or your mother?
Yeah, it happened. You know, I guess it's the maturation process. It's, you know, being an adult yourself, you know, but I also started just to remember my father's laughter, you know, and he was funny. He used to go around the house singing all the time. You know, he had a great tenor voice. His idol was John McCormick, and I'd find him in the kitchen sometimes singing, for I've lately took a notion for to cross the briny ocean, and I'm off to Philadelphia, you know, that famous folk song, you know, and he loved all that stuff, and I'd hear him doing all that and doing these little Jackie Gleason and Away We Go motions, you know. He was a funny character, and so now when I think about him, as opposed to always these negative things that I thought about when I was in my teens and in my 20s, I hear him laugh now. And that's liberating for me and for him, too, I think.
We're recording this interview during Black History Month, and I wonder what you think of Black History Month. I know in broadcasting, it's often the opportunity where we're like, well, let's invite on some black people because it's Black History Month, and in February we have on black people. Do you know what I mean? It's on the one hand, I think, a kind of way of ghettoizing Black history and black people. On the other hand, it's a time to kind of celebrate black history. Which do you feel more defines the month?
It's a ghettoization, undoubtedly, of the culture. I'm a reporter, and I'm often asked, or have in the past, could you do something special for Black History mm-hmm. Month? Or what happens is that lots of white reporters and other people do these great stories, and they say, well, why aren't we doing this all year long? These are great stories. And that's precisely the point. There is no White History Month,
I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for discussing your new book with us. Thank you for
being
here.
Thank you for having me.
Ida Barrianjeri is a writer for the Los Angeles Times. Her new memoir, Every